Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you all enjoying the nice warm weather?
Oh, yeah.
I realize it's supposed to get to 37. It's supposed to get like to 37 today. That's 60 degrees warmer than it was Monday night when it was about 24 below. So that's nice. Well, this morning I'm going to talk about right speech. And this is part one of a two-part series about right speech. The second part is going to be given by Susan in 2 weeks on January 26th. Hi, Susan. Susan and I have both been interested for quite a long time on in communication within the Sangha, and so we're working together on this. And it seems like this is a good time to talk about right speech. We're still pretty close to New Year's Day, and we've been making resolutions. It's a good time for making resolutions or taking precepts. Last Sunday, I wasn't here. I was at the Northfield Buddhist Meditation Center, and I was leading the group there and reciting the precepts. They have a lovely tradition of doing that every year. But of course, paying attention to right speech is always important. It's not just something we do once a year. It's something we can work on every single day. We spend so much of our time talking, and there are so many opportunities to be kind and helpful with our speech. And there are so many pitfalls. There are so many ways that we can be unskillful in speech. I wonder how many times a day do I think to myself, I could have said that better. I could have said that in a more skillful way if I had just maybe paused a little bit. So I'm not setting myself up as a paragon of right speech. There are times when I engage in unskillful speech. I've probably done that. I'm sure I've done that with people in this room. And I hope when that happens, you'll be forgiving and understanding. This is really a lifelong pursuit, something we can continue to work on. So it's always good to look at right speech. And in addition to that, Susan and I have a specific reason for looking at it now. And that reason is that in the coming months, we're going to offer something to the Sangha called a council process. That's something we've done here in the past. And I know some of you have participated. But it's been a while. And we feel that the community could really benefit from council process at this time. Council process is a way of getting together and speaking about what's in your heart in a very open sort of way. And we're hoping that this will become an ongoing thing, and it'll be a resource for the community, something that we can turn to in good times and bad to have good communications. So that's why the title of this talk is Right Speech and Sangha, as opposed to simply right speech. So my plan this morning is to talk about right speech using the Buddha's own words, and then I'll explain a little bit at the end about how council process works, what it is, and I'm going to talk a little bit then about how the intentions of council process correlate with the Buddha's ideas about right speech. And right speech, of course, is part of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the Buddha's method for following his way. The Eightfold Path consists of right view, resolve, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And, of course, they all contribute to each other, and they're all really the same in a way. So we say right speech. But when we say right speech, we don't really mean right in the sense of right or wrong. This isn't a moral judgment. It's really about wholeness or completeness. If you engage in speech skillfully, you're going to be happier. You're going to act in accordance with things as they are. Your life is going to be more whole and more complete. A better translation might be perfect speech. But right speech is much more common, and that's what I'm going to use this morning. So I went to the Buddha's discourses to see what the Buddha had to say about right speech. I have this book, The Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha, and these are the suttas. They were remembered by Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, and they were written down a few centuries after the Buddha's death. This is a Theravadin text, and it uses the Pali word sutta rather than the Sanskrit word sutra, which many of us are more familiar with. But sutta is the word I'm going to use this morning. So the Buddha gives a definition of right speech in the Sakavibhanga Sutta, and it's on your program, and it's pretty short. He says, "And what, friends, is right speech? Abstaining from false speech, abstaining from malicious speech, abstaining from harsh speech, and abstaining from idle chatter. This is called right speech." So I think it's pretty obvious that right speech arises from an aspiration not to hurt others, in that we avoid false, malicious, or harsh speech. But it also arises, I think, from the aspiration to have a strong practice. There's the part about abstaining from idle chatter, and I think that is consistent with having a strong practice, avoiding distractions, avoiding monkey mind. If we don't spend a lot of our time in idle chatter, our practice is going to be stronger because we're going to be more mindful. But of course, avoiding false, malicious, or harsh speech is going to help your practice as well, because these types of speech are more likely to hurt you than they are to hurt the intended target. They're going to interfere with your practice. So this list of things, you'll note, false, malicious, harsh speech, and idle chatter, these are all things we should avoid. But right speech also can be looked at, I think, in a very positive way. It's not all about avoiding verbal misconduct, avoiding doing the wrong thing. It's also about engaging in noble, taintless speech, to use the Buddha's words. It can be kind and supportive and affirming. And as our practice deepens, I think in the beginning it's more about being negative, or more about seeing the negative and avoiding it and trying to change our negative behavior. But as our practice deepens, it's more about positive behavior spontaneously arising. So to explore the Buddha's view of right speech in a little more depth, I'd like to go over a few excerpts. I'm going to look first at the Kakakupama Sutta. Kakakupama Sutta. So this one, which I will now call the simile of the saw, is the story of a guy named Paguna. And it starts with, "Thus have I heard." That's Ananda speaking. He's recounting what the Buddha said. "On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Maliya Paguna, that would be one of the Buddha's monks, was associating overmuch with bhikkhunis." Uh-oh, here's a problem. So he's a bhikkhu. He's a male monk. Bhikkhunis are the female monks, or nuns, as they're often called. He's associating overmuch with them. "He was associating so much with bhikkhunis that if any bhikkhu spoke dispraise of those bhikkhunis in his presence, he would become angry and displeased and would rebuke him." So this anger is arising if anyone says anything bad about the bhikkhunis. So what's going on here? I'm not sure. I mean, remember... We can imagine. Okay. This is a celibate monk, you know, and they have a lot of rules. And it could be, you know, there's a hint that there could be some sexual misconduct here. But I doubt that's what's going on. I think they're hanging out together, and that this monk is, they're looking to each other, I think, for emotional support. They're looking to each other to get their emotional needs met, enough so that an attachment has arisen here and anger is arising. So it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for a monk who has taken these vows to do this. The sutta adds here that if any bhikkhu spoke dispraise of Maliya, the bhikkhunis became angry and displeased and would rebuke him. So the Buddha called him in one day, basically, and had a little talk with him. And he said, "Paguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith, from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of any of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. That is how you should train, Paguna. So he's saying if someone maligns these bhikkhunis, you should not respond with hatred. Now, I'm sure he's not saying don't protect the bhikkhunis, don't stand up for the bhikkhunis if someone is maligning them wrongly. What he's saying is don't let hatred enter into it. Don't let your attachment and your emotion enter into that. Let the self go here. So that's kind of our ideal of right speech when it comes to these things like anger. My mind will be unaffected. I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for the welfare of others with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. And then after talking to Pagana, he goes on to address all of the monks. And he comes up with this little story to talk about how we can work on right speech. And he says, suppose there were a big sela tree grove near a village or town, and it was choked with castor oil weeds, and someone would appear desiring the good welfare and protection of this grove. What would he do? He would cut down and throw out the crooked saplings that rob the sap. He would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight, well-formed saplings so that the sela tree grove later on would come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So he's very carefully tending this grove, preserving the good trees, removing the bad trees, so that in the future it can be a very healthy and beautiful grove. So too, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourselves to wholesome states. For that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this dharma and discipline. And I like that because it's just so, it's just one thing after another. It's just doing the thing that's in front of us, taking care of this sapling right here, taking care of this bit of speech here, and just working on these things very methodically. And doing them one at a time and knowing that in the future, if we continue to do this, we will have a beautiful grove or we will have a beautiful understanding of the Dharma. And then, continuing with the same sutta, he goes into another story involving right speech. And this is a story of a housewife named Vedahika. Now, Vedahika had a great reputation as being a kind, gentle, and peaceful person. And she had a maid, and the maid's name was Kali. Kali was clever and nimble and neat in her work. And Kali asked herself one day, why is it that Vedahika never shows anger? She's curious about that. Is it because there is no anger in her? Or is it that anger is in her, but the conditions giving rise to that anger never occur? In other words, is the reason she's never angry that my work is always good? So she decided to test her. And she tested her by sleeping in late one day to see what would happen. She deliberately slept in late. And she found that Vedahika did have a little bit of anger. She called Kali a wicked girl, and she scowled. And Kali thought, I'm going to test her a little more. So on a subsequent occasion, she slept in even a little later. And at that point, Vedahika spoke more words of displeasure. And she said, well, I'm going to try this again. I'm going to sleep in even later. She slept in even later. And on that occasion, Vedahika took a rolling pin, gave her a blow in the head, and cut her head. And Kali went running into the street, denouncing her mistress, whose reputation suffered greatly after that. So, interesting experiment, and she learned something there. And then the Buddha, after recounting this story, says, so too, bhikkhus, some bhikkhu is extremely kind, extremely gentle, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him. But it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him that it can be understood whether that bhikkhu is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. So I like this story because it reminds us that the true test of right speech is when things go wrong. How are we going to do then? It's easy to be pleasant when everything is pleasant. But I think we'll find the measure of our practice when things are unpleasant. If there's a conflict with one of our best friends, if there's conflict in our community, in our Sangha, how are we going to be then? You know, we can't be so sure until that happens. So I think we shouldn't be too quick to congratulate ourselves on our even tempers if we're not being tested. And I think that reminds us that all of this takes a great deal of effort. It's something we all have to keep working on. And then continuing with the same sutta, the Buddha tells us more about how to train. He talks about how there are five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely. You know, they might say the right thing, but at the wrong time. It may be true or untrue. It may be gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness, or with inner hate. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Your mind should remain unaffected, utter no evil words, abide compassionate with their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So, sending loving kindness out to the entire world. So in this sutta, you could say, we learn that right speech is compassionate and it's patient. And this sutta sets forth a kind of ideal. And I think we need to recognize we may not be there yet. And if we're not there yet, if we have lapses, we must be forgiving. We must see the lapse, kind of examine it a little, decide we'll do a little better next time, learn from our mistakes. And if we do engage in angry speech now and then, we must acknowledge the anger, we must examine it, we must allow ourselves to feel it, not suppress it, but not indulge it. So next I'd like to look at another sutta, the Abhayara Jakumara Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. Doesn't that sound like a nice place? So this is kind of a complicated story, and there are four characters. So let's talk about the characters. First we have Prince Abhaya. He's a son of King Bimbisara of Magadha, whom some of you have heard of. So Prince Abhaya. We have Nagantha Nataputta. Nagantha Nataputta is the head of another spiritual group. They're not Buddhist. They're different. And so he's a... Did I say something funny? Did I say they're not different?
No.
I said they're different. Okay. So it's cool. See, I'm a little on the edge about right speech here. So Nagantha Nataputta, he's a spiritual leader, contemporary of the Buddha. I think they have a little rivalry going here. And then we have Devadatta. Devadatta is the Buddha's very troublesome cousin who has plotted against the Buddha, opposed him, and even on one occasion tried to kill him. A real problem. Then we have the Buddha himself. So one day Prince Abhaya reported to Nagantha Nataputta that the Buddha has apparently made a mistake. He's kind of ratting out the Buddha. He says, I can't believe it, what the Buddha said. Buddha said really bad things about Devadatta. He said, Devadatta is destined for the states of privation, for hell. He will remain in hell for the eon. Devadatta is incorrigible. Now, Nagantha thinks, okay, this is my chance to really show the Buddha up for what he is. And so he instructs Prince Abhaya to go to the Buddha and ask him a question. He says, ask him thus, would the Buddha utter speech that would be unwelcome or disagreeable to others? And he says, you know, if the Buddha says yes, then you can point out that the Buddha is no different from everybody else. He says things that are disagreeable to others. He's a phony. He's just a regular guy. If he says no, you can ask him, okay then, why did you say those terrible things about Devadatta? Then you're a liar. He says, when the recluse Gotama is posed this two-horned question by you, he will not be able either to gulp it down or to throw it up. And you can just kind of see him rubbing his hands together. Yeah, we got him. We got him. So Prince Abhaya went to the Buddha and he asked this question. Would the Buddha utter speech that would be unwelcome or disagreeable to others? The Buddha replied, there is no one-sided answer to that, Prince. That's our guy. It's not that simple. There's no yes or no here. And Prince Abhaya said to the Buddha, then, Venerable Sir, the Nagantha has lost in this. And he comes clean and he tells Buddha the whole story. So there is no one-sided answer to this question of whether it is right speech to say things that are disagreeable to others. And the Buddha explains this to the monks. And he says, he asks the question, what if an infant put a stick or a pebble in his mouth? What would you do? Well, of course, you'd reach in and you'd take it out. And what if you were swallowing it and you had to be kind of rough doing this? And what if you even drew blood? Well, you would still do it, right? Because of compassion, because you're saving the infant's life. And the Buddha says, similarly, sometimes I will use speech that is true, correct, and beneficial, yet is unwelcome and disagreeable to others. So right speech is direct, and it is honest. Sometimes it means saying things that are hard to say. Sometimes it means confronting bad behavior in a loving and yet direct way. And direct speech is something that that some of us have to work on. I think there are two categories of people that have a hard time engaging in direct speech, and those are Buddhists and Minnesotans. And I fall under both categories. So I've been working on this for a long time. And I've made some progress. I found something quite simple to help. And it's just the idea of taking the ego out of it. Because I think our hesitancy to engage in direct speech really comes from ego. It's from the desire to be liked and the desire to be comfortable and the desire not to have to do difficult things. So when I need to be direct, I prepare, I think about it. And I try to set aside those desires. And I try to just do what's best for all. What needs to be done here, and then I do it compassionately, kindly, and firmly. So, then this sutta takes a turn in another direction, which at first to me seemed random and unrelated, but I think it does make a really good point. So the prince, in the same conversation, asked the Buddha a question. And here I'm paraphrasing a little bit. He says, when people come to you with a question, you always have an answer. Now, why is that? Is that because you think to yourself, oh, I could get this question and this is how I'll answer because you're anticipating? Or does the answer occur to you on the spot? And his reply is to ask him, Prince, are you skilled in the parts of a chariot? And the prince says, oh, yeah, I know all about a chariot. I know all about all the parts. And he says, if someone asks you a question about the parts of a chariot and you answer, is it because you anticipated the question? And he says, well, no, it's just that I know all about the chariot and I come up with an answer on the spot. And the Buddha says, it's the same way with me. I have fully penetrated reality, and because I have fully penetrated reality, the answer occurs to me on the spot. There is a point to this little exchange, I think. We might say that right speech has an element of spontaneity or immediacy. If we spend too much of our time anticipating possible questions, it really takes us away from the moment when the question occurs. I think we can trust what arises in the moment. Of course, sometimes we need to plan carefully what we're going to say, but there is also the idea that if I really bring my full heart to this moment and answer the question, I'll come up with a truer answer. And then a couple more things. Uh, short one. The Aranavibhanga Sutta, the exposition of non-conflict, the Buddha says, one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. Here, bhikkhus, when one speaks hurriedly, one's body grows tired, and one's mind becomes excited. One's voice is strained, and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. So right speech is not rushed. When we are deliberate, we give ourselves time to think about what we're going to say. It's more pleasing to the listener, I think, when we speak slowly. We can convey so much with our tone of voice, our kindness, and peace of mind. And I think this also means we don't fire off our thoughts too quickly. You know, we think before we talk. It can get us into trouble to fire our thoughts off too quickly. And here I'm thinking about email. Has anyone in this room ever sent an email and then kind of regretted that you sent it? Yeah, I know about that. So it's interesting to think what kind of emails the Buddha would send. Would the Buddha LOL? Probably not. Probably not. I think that's a little too close to allowing one's mind to be excited. I think the Buddha would SS, serene smile. So, my wife Kathy is in communications, and she says sometimes people will bring her an email and they'll say, I don't know if I should send this, it doesn't seem quite right. And she says, you just answered your own question. If you have that feeling, do not send it. You know, call them up, talk in person, or think about it for a day, and then rewrite it. So, what kind of email would the Buddha send? I think he'd have a preference for speaking in person. But if he had to use email, I think he would really take the time to make sure that his kindness came through. You know, I think he'd really back away and put it in that context of kindness, you might say. So right speech is also unhurried. Then in that same sutta, the Buddha says, one should not insist on local language. I love this one. In different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a bowl, a vessel, a saucer, a pan, a pot, a mug, a basin. And he gives the Pali words for these. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, one speaks accordingly, firmly adhering to that expression and insisting only this is correct, anything else is wrong. So we've probably all experienced things like this. This makes me think of my mom, who is very compassionate, but could have her little hang-ups, bless her heart. We moved from Iowa to North Dakota when I was 3, and there are some differences of expression between Northwest Iowa and Southeastern North Dakota. And I remember one day I was at school, and I said something about my aunt. My teacher said, oh, don't say aunt. An aunt is a little thing that crawls on the ground. Say aunt. Okay, that's fine. I'm here to learn. Sure. So I go home and I say something about my aunt. And my mom is like, it's not aunt. We don't say aunt. And she was just really offended because, you know, our way of talking is the correct way. And it wasn't until years later that I realized what was going on. I mean, it's fine to be proud of the way you speak and to want to preserve the way you speak and all of that. But if you think your way of talking is superior, you know, that's really something to look at. And of course, this thing about local language, it's not just about local language. It's really about our view of the world. There are so many different ways where we can think, well, what I do is the right way, and what everyone else does is the wrong way. And if it's unfamiliar and if it's different, it must be wrong. And of course, that's the heart of the matter in Buddhism, overcoming that filter of judgment and that preference for our own view. So I think we could say that right speech is also very giving, in that it involves giving up our personal view. So that's something about right speech in general. It's compassionate, patient, direct, honest, spontaneous, unhurried, and giving. And of course, there are exceptions. These aren't ironclad rules. Sometimes hurried speech may be the appropriate thing. Sometimes planned speech is appropriate rather than spontaneous speech. It's all about the a matter of doing the proper thing at the proper time. So now I would like to turn to council process just a bit and answer the question, what is it? There are different forms of it. As we've practiced it here, you get people together who want to participate. You form a circle. There is a facilitator who gives pretty extensive instructions on careful listening, spontaneity, speaking from the heart, things like that. And the facilitator may pose a question. Or if it's a general council, there may not be any specific topic. It may be just each person talking about what they think needs to be said. And there's a talking piece, something you hand around the circle, and you can only talk when you're holding the talking piece. That means everyone listens intently to the person who is talking, and it brings a kind of a solemnity to the proceedings, which is really nice. I've participated in quite a few councils in quite a few different settings, and I've always found them powerful. I think they always increase people's understanding of each other. I think if they're called to deal with a specific problem, they always bring people a little closer to knowing what to do about the problem. And sometimes they make it actually very clear. And the origins of council process are in Native American tradition, not in Buddhist tradition. The Iroquois used them. Native Americans from the plains and the southwestern Pueblos used them. So it's not from the Buddhist tradition, but I think it's remarkably consistent with Buddhist views. Council process has been used extensively by our sister center in St. Paul, Clouds in Water. That's where I got my training in it. And I have a list of 5 council intentions that I received at that training, and I took a look at them. The first is speaking from the heart. That is the essence of council. That is consistent, I think, with the compassion and the honesty that I've been talking about. It's compassionate to open ourselves up, to be vulnerable, to be willing to hear the thoughts of others while setting aside our own thoughts, to really open our own heart in that way. And it's not so easy to do. So we're not holding something back because it preserves our power in the situation. We're letting ourselves be a little powerless, perhaps. Next is listening from the heart, and that is letting go of the self and being totally present. And I think that's consistent with the patience I talked about, since you really need to be patient to be a good listener, and it's consistent with the local language thing. Be open to the views of others, not self-centered. Listen with your whole heart. Be like the river Ganges. At some point in here, the Buddha talks about how when you are in the presence of angry thoughts or something like this, be like the river Ganges. He said, imagine somebody coming with a torch. They have a grass torch and they say, I'm going to dry up the river Ganges with the grass torch. Well, of course, that is totally impossible to do. The river Ganges is almost infinite. We should be like the river Ganges in our infinite patience. That's our ideal. The next council intention is lean expression. That's the third one, I think. Lean expression, take responsibility for delivering your message concisely. The stories I've told about the Buddha don't really touch on lean expression, but I think if we look at the Buddha's manner of speaking, we see very lean expression there. It's true that there's a great deal of repetition in this book, a lot of repetition, but I think is mostly an aid to memorization. But if you look at the Buddha's words, he never brings in sort of an extraneous story or background that doesn't really help with his point. Next is spontaneity. Try not to rehearse what you are going to say ahead of time. Trust emergence. Trust what may emerge. Right there at that moment in council, you may realize something new, and that's very powerful. And that fits the Buddha's talk about the parts of the chariot, coming up with the answer on the spot. And of course, that is consistent with our Zen teachings of living in the moment. And the fifth intention of council process is confidentiality. Don't reveal what is said in the council outside the council. So we have three council process sessions planned. We're going to do them after tea on the first Sunday of February, March, and April. And more information will be provided. I don't think we've decided the exact time yet. The first one is going to be on a very specific topic. It's going to have to do with the challenges we've faced during the past year in regard to our leadership decisions here. So that probably won't be for everyone. If you've been affected by that and want to come and talk about that and hear what others have to say about that, please do come. The other two, the ones after that, will likely be on more broad subject matter, more likely appropriate for everyone who wants to come. But we're going to see what happens. We'll see what happens with the first one. And we'll let this be what it needs to be. And we'll provide more specifics later. Susan's talk in 2 weeks, I think we'll probably have more specifics about council process. We'll see. Susan very generously said, just talk about what you want to talk about and I'll fill in the gaps. So that made it kind of easy for me. So that's basically what I have to say this morning, and I thank you so much for listening. And I'd be happy to entertain comments or questions, if there are any. Yes?
There, it was interesting, when Lou was talking about there being no one-sided answer, and then went on to describe situations where he spoke, and it may be that whatever he said caused some problem with the person listening or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm struck by the fact that, of course, the suttas and sutras present Buddha as an idealization and not as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
How helpful is this way of presenting the Buddha?
Maybe not so helpful. I think, you know, the Buddha was a highly, highly realized being, and is probably presented honestly in a lot of ways. But we know he made mistakes. We know he initially didn't want to admit women into the Sangha. I think that was a big mistake. And I think about teachers in general. I think idealizing teachers is not a good thing. You know, teachers are human. Teachers make mistakes. And if we put them on a pedestal too much, we are doing everyone a disservice. Would you agree?
There's no one-sided answer to that.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
I'm curious about, let's say out in the marketplace, you know, in a regular kind of world where you're meeting up with people of all different stages in their life and in their worldview, what would the Mahayana perspective be about, you know, I mean, I understand, you know, some of that high-level speaking and that mind way, but when you're talking about someone who's, you know, on the bus or someone who's, you know, up a kind of in your face and, you know, different. What would it say about speaking to people? You know, how do you find out what worldview they're at, and how is it more effective to speak in the way at that, you know, place that person's at? Because just speaking on some super high level all the time might be quote perfect, but it's not. It's going to just go over heads, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just struggle with that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an answer to your own question in there when you said, you know, how do you see what their worldview is? I think right speech is very skillful, and you take into account the person that you're talking to and what they're going to understand. And you present things in a skillful way, which means if you kind of come off in this high-minded, if you're on the bus, you know, and they're kind of in your face, and you say, well, the Buddha said, you know, you're probably not going to really get through. So being skillful, I think being right there with them, really present and seeing where they're at, hopefully is going to help you to respond in a way that's that's going to work. It's not always easy. Sometimes you may miss completely. You know, you just may not find that common ground. But being open, even in a stressful situation, if you can keep your presence of mind, not let your anger take over, not let your fear take over, but keep your presence of mind and say, what is this? Where is this person coming from? I mean, if they're angry, it's coming from some kind of pain or fear or hurt, right? Maybe you can see that. Maybe you can see what's underneath. Sometimes you hear stories about people who see the pain that's underneath and they react to that, you know? And it just kind of diffuses the situation. Guy was telling the story about the kid in the grocery store who was just running amok. And some skillful person came up and said, and so the mother was getting really upset with the kid and just, you know, about ready to hit the kid. And a skillful person came up and said, oh, what a wonderful, curious child, you know, and praised the child. And that just completely sort of disarmed the mother. And she said, yeah, he really is something, you know. So she saw kind of the pain underneath that, the mom's pain, the mom's maybe fear that she would look bad in the grocery store or something like that. That was a good story. Yes?
Yes. I would like to make a point because I'm very confused now. When we're talking to somebody, hearing somebody, and I think that we got a tendency to mix the messenger with the message.
Mm-hmm.
A filter, what the message here is talking about, and leave the personal part of it. And that may be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And
so. I think so. If we confuse the messenger with the message, we have what the person is saying, and then we have kind of our preconceived ideas of what that person is.
We're starting to judge not the message, but we're judging how he's a messenger. Okay.
Right.
And maybe when we talk a high level, what high level of knowledge or how level of content of the message.
Yeah. And I think all of that is part of clear seeing. We come back to that again, clear seeing of the person you're talking to. And I think that's something that this Buddhist practice can really help us with. Because as we sit, we become more familiar with the kinds of emotions and prejudgments that tend to cloud our thinking. And as we become more familiar with those fall away somewhat, and we're not so much governed by them. You know, we still maybe have them, they arise, but then we see them. Oh, that's my prejudgment. That's that thing from my childhood that says this kind of person is bad, which is totally irrational. You know, we see that. There's a thinking process that helps us see that, and then there's something really deeper that helps us see that, too. And so the practice really helps us to drop those preconceptions and really be present with that person and hear the message. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
I'm really excited about your conference. You're going to begin council circles, and I just, as you were dialoguing here, I had an idea, which when you said you wanted to start the first one about leadership here, that sounds really great.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to just add, I think it would also be good to maybe even have part of that be about leadership here, but leadership in the world and leadership in our lives. I think the relationships we all have is one kind of leadership just in relationship. I think that whatever's happening here is happening in the world, in our personal lives and social, political context. But I think it'd be great if you could expand that so we can touch on, with the microcosm of it, some the macrocosm of it.
That's a nice idea. Sometimes in council you might have two questions. You know, you go two rounds. Maybe one's more macro, one's more micro. So that's an interesting idea. We'll look at that. Thank you.
Okay.
Anything else?
One question, please. How do we know if our attitude or our questions are the questions that we really want to do? Because normally, I feel many times that I prepare my question according to the answer I want. If I don't want to go to do the shopping, I'm going to say, Oh, how is the weather today? Instead of saying, you see, I mean, it's not it's checking all the time, because I think that our worst enemy is right here.
Right, right.
And how we check on ourselves that we are doing the right thing and we are not cheating on us.
Yeah, I think rigorous honesty with ourselves, which is not an easy thing to do, but examining our motives. Hanging out with people who are willing to be direct with us, you know, I think, can be really helpful as well. Thank you.
Thank you.